Thank you so much. Can everybody hear me well?
Yes.
Okay, I'm just gonna be loud because there's no mic, and that's fine. That works out very well. I'm also gonna be totally tethered to the desk because I need to change the slides, and there's no access to the clicker there. But I'm so delighted to be here. I also can't see you through my reading glasses. I'm so delighted to be here. I have only been to Austin one time, and it was almost exactly 10 years ago. I think it was right after my sixth child was born. It was a brief visit to see some colleagues and research, and I just enjoyed the city very much, but it was just like a day or 2 days, so I don't know anything about the city. And arriving at the airport today, I thought, this is weird. And then I thought, this is cool. And then I realized that's kind of like the thing everybody thinks about Austin. It's like weird and cool, right? So that I just kind of made that note that the airport strikes one that way. So anyway, super delightful to be here, and mostly the people I know on the faculty here are the few people you probably know them, they're Catholics. So I know Mark Ignaris is a good friend and a colleague and someone I've worked with in the Department of Sociology, and I know Rob Coons in philosophy and Jay Budusevsky, and that might be the sum total of faculty that I know here, but anyway, super delighted to be here, and thank you for hosting me. I'm also very grateful for that nice introduction, and so maybe a brief note of apology. This is one topic that I speak about that seems to have nothing to do with my academic training, and it doesn't really. So how did I start writing and speaking about Eustein? In large part, I started reading her when I was in high school, really as a disciple or somebody that I discovered. I had a teacher who showed some of her work to me, and I thought, this is some of the coolest thing I've ever read. And so all throughout, you know, college and then into graduate school, I spent a lot of time reading her work. And at some point, it was just a long story, I started kind of leading study groups on her, and that just kind of developed into a thing. So this is really a work of love. Like, studying Eustein for me is a work of love. She's somebody that I find every time I go back to certain passages I know very well, just more and more richness. And I think she's more thought about than she is studied. So for the Thomistic Institute, one of the things that's been a real pleasure is to share really her thought. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about her just to kind of get things going. But what I really want to do is just share some of her thoughts about feminine, right? Which for Eustein, because she is a philosopher, she's by what I mean there is she's a very analytical person. So she's not going to tell you what she thinks about women without implicating something about man at the same time. So this, I think you will find this broadly interesting. So that is my hope, is just to really bring her to life a little bit for you, and so you'll leave knowing a lot more about her. And the other hope is that you'll pick her up and read her after I'm done here tonight, because really that's the best gift I could give you. So. Without further ado, let me see if I can, I'm going to sort of leave, let's see, I'm going to leave this for you, but I'm not going to speak about this yet. So one of the wonderful reasons to talk about Eustein under the auspices of the Thomistic Institute, right, St. Thomas is a Dominican, but we don't think about St. Eustein in connection with the Dominicans very often, but I often argue that we should. And one of the reasons I like to say that is because she's probably the Dominicans have the second best reason to claim her besides the Carmelites. So why is that the case? So of course she became a Carmelite at the end of her life, Eustein did, and she was also converted by a Carmelite. Did you know this? She was largely converted spiritually by reading the autobiography of St. Teresa of Avila. Do you know this story? So she was already kind of drawn to arguments about the faith, and then read the autobiography of Teresa of Avila and kind of put it down and said, this is the truth, and kind of let me in, right? And then it was a process. So she has a lot of connection to the Carmelites. But why does she have a lot of connection to the Dominican order? So the first thing that we have to think about with Edith is that she was possessed of a very extraordinary philosophical spirit. And the Dominicans like to think of themselves as sort of the philosophical heavyweights in the Catholic Church. The Franciscans, of course, are going to make a claim there that sort of there's like an ongoing historical, you know, battle of spirits between the Franciscans and the Dominicans. The Dominicans like to claim for themselves sort of philosophical superiority. They're the winning team, they think. So because Edith was such an extraordinarily philosophical spirit, she has that connection. So many people study philosophy. Maybe there are some philosophy majors here. I don't know. Any? Couple? So a few. But very few people, I would say, and I'm married to a philosopher, so I can say this, very few people are so philosophical in their sort of general disposition that they are pained or distressed at any distraction from the life of the mind. You may know people like that. They're usually annoying to be with. this is true. But Edith Stein was one of these kind of people. And I would say that because this is sort of an antisocial type of disposition, it's even rarer in a woman to be so philosophical that you are. And so like an example of this, for instance, towards the end of her life when she was living in one of the Carmelite monasteries in Belgium in the last couple of years before she was deported to Auschwitz, she said that her favorite day of the week was Sunday. And why was that the case? Because on Sunday she didn't do any philosophical work, which meant that no time in the day she was drawn away from her work. Whereas the other days she would have these hours devoted to philosophical work, her writing, but the bell would ring and you're in a monastery, you don't get to decide when you go to dinner, right? You have to go. And the most horrible thing was to be called away in the middle of a thought. So she hated, you know, Monday through Saturday, but Sunday. But this is just to give you, that's how philosophical she was. So this is the first thing. After her conversion in 1921, she began to read fairly voraciously in the Catholic tradition, and not only from the mystics where she began, like with St. Teresa of Avila, but then she did systematically kind of walk through the philosophical works in the history of the church, and she did begin reading a lot from St. Thomas Aquinas, right? So she, even though in terms of philosophical traditions, we don't think of Edith Stein actually as a Thomist, for instance, that was not a tradition she was working in, although she was completely, you know, really interested in St. Thomas, is very interesting. So in this sense, sort of her philosophical outlook, we can kind of claim her for the Dominicans. There's another reason to attach Edith Stein also to the Dominican order, and this is because after she finished her PhD, she was not able to hold a university chair. She couldn't teach in a university. So why was that? I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. So because she couldn't teach at university, she basically went to teach at a school for girls in Germany, a private school for girls. And this school was in a town called Speyer, and it was run by Dominican sisters. So this is after she's converted to Catholicism. But she wants very much to teach at university. She can't, so she goes off and teaches at this basically an elite kind of prep school for you know, well-off girls in Germany who are Catholic. And the school is run by Dominican sisters, so she moves in with this Dominican order of nuns who are teaching, and she lives there for 12 years. Now, 12 years is a long time. So she's a new convert from sort of philosophical atheism, but of course she was a Jewish woman who grew up Jewish, then became an atheist at the age of, I think, 14, and then became an intellectual convert. So at Speyer is the place where she first lives community life of the church. So she starts to go to daily mass and liturgy of the hours. She participates then in the devotions of the Dominican saints. She starts to receive, you know, confession frequently from the Dominican fathers who are coming. So she, this was a deeply formative period of time for her, and you can kind of think of this as the time when she's sort of habitually born into the church, and she starts to live the liturgy of the church and understand its seasons. So, you know, there's a sense in which that kind of rebirth into the church that that takes place for her. It happens under the auspices of the Dominicans. And the whole rest of her life, she carries on a lively correspondence with the Dominican sisters that she knew there. So I do think it's impossible to give a fair appraisal of Edith's life without taking into account her relationship with the Dominican order. So this is all just to say it's a really good thing to be thinking about Edith Stein in the context of the Thomistic Institute. Now, in the time that Edith spent at Speyer as a teacher of girls, that's an important time for this topic because it's because she was teaching girls that she spent an awful lot of time thinking about what we would call today, and you think she would be writing today if you read these writings, she would call them the problems of contemporary girls' education, for instance, if she'd think. So she thought a lot about that, and because of that, because of thinking about how to educate girls, she's a philosopher, right? One of the things about philosophers is even when they say that now I'm going to be practical, they're still doing theory. This is very famous. So she has all these essays and practical problems related to the girls' education. It's all theory. There's nothing practical at all. But for her, practical is, well, what is a girl? Well, a girl is becoming a woman. Well, what is a woman? Well, all right, well, a woman is this thing. And then, well, if a woman is this thing and a girl is becoming a woman, well, then how should we educate a girl to become a woman, right? So that's what, for her, counts as practical thought. You don't want to read her philosophical abstract thought. But because of that, that's why we have these essays where she talks about what it is to be a woman. Because she's teaching girls for 12 years, so she's very logically kind of thinking, well, what the heck are we doing? And one of the things that's really refreshing about this stuff, some of the stuff in my book for you, is that, you know, does anybody think about this now? You kind of go, well, maybe this would help a lot. You know, if we thought that education ought to be, like, pegged to what you're supposed to become. That's a kind of refreshing thought. So that's where she worked on most of the essays I'm quoting tonight are collected in this book. Some of you might have this book, and some of you may not. I think this is in one tiny, well, it's not tiny, but it's one fairly slim volume, is all of the work she wrote directly on women. And some of it's directly on women, and some of it's on women's education. And as I said, it's none of it's practical. It's really great. So briefly, just a couple of pieces of biographical information. She was born in 1891, so she's now a little bit over 100 years old. She was born in the city of Breslau in Germany, and she was born to a deeply observant religious Jewish family. She was the youngest of 11 children, like the baby girl of 11 children. She renounced her Jewish faith already when she was a teenager, which was a really big source of sorrow for her mother. Her mother was an older woman at this point, and really, you know, was, by all accounts, a really devoted, wonderful mother. She was totally heartbroken. Edith was, in some ways, she was the baby. We were just talking about what happens with the baby in the family. My baby is 3, you know, and he certainly worship him. I mean, he's just, you know, like, just the, we just adore him. So I can imagine if I'm, you know, my baby grows up and at the age of 12 just renounces everything I even believe in, right? So completely heartbreaking. So this poor woman was totally heartbroken. And Edith loved her a great deal. And so as she, later in her life, reflecting on her teenagehood, she was rebellious and kind of headstrong. And obviously she's like this independent thinker. She's not taking anything anyone else's say-so. But she had a lot of pain later looking back, thinking about what pain she caused her mother. It was kind of touching to read about that. She was a brilliant student, like already when she was a little tiny kid. She was a very brilliant student. So she distinguished herself early on. She did pursue studies after high school, which would have begun earlier than for us, like more close to the age of 16, college studies. She pursued them in philosophy, sort of straight away. And at first she studied in Breslau, which is where her home was, but then she moved to Göttingen because it was a better university and she was already kind of, people said, we don't know what to do with her, she's too smart, we can't educate her. So to ship her off to this other place. And it was in Göttingen that she wrote, that she worked with the philosopher Edmund Husserl, who's a famous phenomenologist. She took a break during that time when she was studying for her doctoral degree. She took a break during that time and served as a nurse in the Red Cross in the First World War. I mean, most people did at that time. It was, you know, the war effort. She ended up coming back. She finished her PhD, wrote a thesis on the subject of empathy, which people know about. During that time, she was also working as the main research assistant to her advisor, Evan Husserl. And that's a subject of a lot of fascination and interest. Then she followed Husserl to Freiburg. And after she finished, essentially, her dissertation, nobody, but not even Husserl, her beloved advisor, would recommend her for a teaching job because she was a woman. So at that time, women were not supposed to. So Husserl said something like, you know, if the position of university professor should be for women, then definitely she should have one. But since it's not, she shouldn't have one. And it was kind of like, oh gosh, you know. So he was not going to break tradition there. So she basically stayed on with him as kind of his, like, assistant. And then, soon after, then left to go teach in Speyer. Before she completely moved to Speyer, she also finished a second dissertation, which is normal to do in Germany, called a habilitation. That she wrote on, wait for it, not empathy, but sentient causality. So that's the, like, definitely less practical. Husserl, again, heaped like the highest praise on the second dissertation. So, I mean, you know, like, if anybody should hold a university chair, she probably should have, and she wanted very much to do that, but never was able to. It's sad. It has been remarked about Edith Stein that she was barred from having a university chair twice. So the first time she was barred because she was a woman, and the second time because she was a Jew. Because later she was associated with some Catholic institutes of higher study, and she couldn't hold those positions at that time because then we're heading into the end of the Third Reich and the beginning of the Second World War, and she couldn't hold those teaching positions either at that time. So it's really a tragic thing for somebody that loved university life so much. She never taught university. So what I'm going to do now is kind of dive into the topic for you, now you know a little bit more about her. I'm going to give essentially a kind of impressionistic account of Edith's view of what the soul of a woman is meant to be like. Impressionistic because I'm not going to give you any kind of argument. I really want to just present you with what it is that she thought. So I want to let her thoughts speak for themselves. So this is my beginning. Okay, so she has this line. This is my clicker doesn't work, but my pointer does work. So that's kind of helpful, right? So you'll notice that I tried to put where possible the essays that these are quoted from. And you notice right away, like, this is a very famous passage that she wrote about the soul of a woman, and it's drawn from the fundamental principles of women's education. She's writing about education, but she just has to kind of move back. So I do mean this sentence to come to you. That is an ideal image of the gestalt of the feminine soul. That's why this lecture is titled the way it's lectured. And I do mean this as a kind of teaser of sorts. You know, like, well, what is that? Right? What is the that which is this is about? But I actually, it's like I need to hold you off, because if we just go to that, what that is, you won't get it, because we have to figure out what she means by gestalt of the soul first. And that's the problem there now, is that we all speak English and she was German, and these words don't translate fully for us, right? And German is a very sophisticated language in which they do a lot of things with language that we don't do. So they can communicate things in one word that we don't have single words for. So that's one of the problems. And those of you that are philosophers will already know kind of what I'm getting at here. So what is it? So gestalt. So gestalt is usually rendered in English as shape or form. So let's just start there. So like the shape or the form of something. So that already means something, right? So now if I say gestalt of the soul, you're kind of like, okay, the shape of the soul, what does that exactly mean? What is the shape of a soul? How could a soul have a shape? But we're not done yet, because a shape or a form for us in English is a static thing, right? Like we could have an abstract shape, like a circle. We know circles don't exist in reality. It's kind of an idea. There's a perfection of a circle. We know lots of things about the perfection of a circle in mathematical terms, geometrical terms. And we know we're never going to see a circle walking down the street. But we do see things that are spherical, right? Things that are spherical. So we say, okay, well, these spherical things have somewhat the character of a circle. So we already kind of know, but that's not there yet. We're not there yet to gestalt, because the problem there is that a circle is still a form that's static. It's one thing. When I talk about the circle in that way, this is a little bit like the Platonic sense of the term form. Did that just go away? That's sad. Okay, because I didn't move the slide fast enough. Hang on, wake up. Hang on. There we go. It woke up. I'm going to start moving these slides a lot faster. So, but I'm still in my teaser for you. There we go. So what we want to do is take this Platonic idea of form, like the circle is to things which are spherical, and we want to complicate it a little bit more to get to gestalt. We want to complicate it a little bit more. And now think about form in relation to something that's living, like a living thing. So a plant. So think about a living thing which is changing and growing over time. So like circles are just circles, and spherical things are similar to circles. But now if we thought about, like, does a plant have an abstract shape? Well, sort of, yes, right? Like, so all oak trees look similar, right? Their leaves are shaped similarly, and their bark will look similar. But we also know that there's such a thing as a baby oak tree, and there's a seed of an oak tree. and there's an adult oak tree, right? And they all kind of, they all, so we know that there's a kind of form that we can think about, like an abstract shape for a living thing, right, with a plant, right? So that helps. That's better than circle and sphere, spherical things. That's better. We've progressed, right? And that we already see with the plant is sort of more difficult. So we want to get even more difficult. So we have the plant, and it's got these different stages. Now, the problem now is that with the plant, the plant doesn't have any agency, right? The plant doesn't make any choices along the way. The plant doesn't wake up and think, like, I don't like the way I'm going. I want to go a different direction. So that's the end point for us, is we're kind of thinking about the gestalt of the human soul. We have this person. And so we have all these difficulties that apply to plant life. Like, we have an abstract form which can grow and change over time. But we have self-direction, right? So we have self-direction. And this besides self-direction, also self-understanding is something that was very important for Edith Stein. And then there's, things like meaning and purpose, right? So all of this sort of philosophically sits as a backdrop to Edith's thoughts about women and about people in general. So for her, right, the soul is this organic, I mean, it has this form, it has a thing, it has like an ideal shape, right? But it's now specific for each person. It has all these different, and I'll get into some specifics for you in a minute. And furthermore, and so interestingly, we know this is true about ourselves, you're also kind of observing yourself growing and making choices over your lifetime. Which is why she thought it was really important to think about what was ideal. Because she thought, well, people would want to know. Like, you'd want to know. You want to be able to check in on yourself when you're, I don't know, my age. Be like, well, am I progressing towards an ideal woman? Right? Like, if I didn't know what the goal was, right? Now, people, of course, in fact, do this. Like, we have all kinds of images of what we think different kinds of perfections are. And people with different interests in life pursue those different kinds of perfections. I have a 19-year-old son who spends a lot of time at the gym right now. And he has a definite idea of what his biceps ought to look like, for instance. I mean, the point is you can borrow all kinds of ideas, right? And so she thought we naturally did that, but that we didn't stop very often to think about what our souls should look like, right? So she thinks like that sense that some of us have, well, like my biceps should look this way, or my figure should look this way, that applied all the more so to the progress of the soul. And that there's such a thing as like a baby soul and a middle-aged soul and an adult soul. And you'd want to maybe stop and check in on your soul. Was it corresponding to something like ideal growth? But for most people, when you start talking about these things, they realize they've never really thought about that much at all. So I think this is very, very helpful. And she thought it was helpful anyway. So where am I? I don't even know where I am. Okay, good. I'm gonna move the slide for you now. All right, so we can move on. So I've said a lot of this, so I'm gonna move through these slides in some cases fairly quickly. So this is just to give you an example of exactly the sorts of things I was just talking about. So this is the kind of language she uses all the time. So you see here sort of this, just as an inner form resides in the seed of plants, an invisible force that makes a fir tree should appear at a beach over there. We find an inner mold set in human beings which urges the evolution into a certain direction. She thought that was a thing, right? So do you see the assimilation to the plants, but also this kind of moving, so there's an urging in a certain direction, but of course for her there's agency now. We layer that on top of that. So here's another example. This is a phrase she uses all the time, so this is a really good one, which is we are trying together to attain insight into this like inner recess of one's being. And she says, as you look at yourself growing and becoming over your lifetime, that you're trying to, you see that you yourself are not a completed being, but you are a being in the state of becoming. It's a great phrase, right? Which gives you both sort of accomplishment, but also potentiality. At every moment, right, you don't have to be done. You're still becoming better. You're still becoming. So you're a being in the state of becoming, right? She uses this phrase all the time. You look at yourself, and we should say, we're trying to achieve clarity relative to this process. I mean, this is part of what she says. This is hard stuff to do. Because we look at ourselves, and we see, like, we want to say, well, what's an ideal woman like? Well, it's not sufficient merely to conclude from what I'm like, because I'm not done yet. That's kind of what part of what she's getting at. She says, our becoming does not remain enclosed within its own confines, but it extends itself, and in extending itself, fulfills itself. So we have to take our cues about ourselves also from other people and our relationships with other people. And then this is a lovely thing that she also says very often, however, all of our being and our becoming, so always these two things, we're already being, but we're also becoming, and our acting in time is ordered from eternity and has a meaning for eternity, and it only becomes clear to us if we put it in light of eternity. So I'm trying to really bring her to life for you. These are classic Edith Stein expressions, all of them. This is how she thinks about what it means to be a person. Okay, here's another one, just to give you more of this is more of the Gestalt, right? The Gestalt is this whole process, right? The soul has this whole process. We will always find fundamentally the compulsion to become what the soul should be. The drive to allow latent humanity, like what's in there, right? What's the potentiality that's there, set precisely in its individual stamp to ripen. So this is the language of fruit, to ripen. You're supposed to ripen like a fruit, to ripen to the greatest possible perfect development. So what's perfect? Has anybody like brought a beautiful pear home from the store? When is it perfect? It's tough, because there's a moment where you're like, it's pretty close to perfect, and then you wait 2 hours too long, and it's just a little past ripe. But I say this because this is the problem, like the sense that, you know, it's not always clear when there's full ripeness, right? And that's one of the things that's so helpful about the organic language that she uses, because it both enlightens the process for us, at least in her mind, but it also, it pardons us from having confusion, right? So it's like, if you're confused about when you're ripe, yeah, that's okay, because, you know, it's hard. Fruit is hard to figure out when it's ripe, and organic processes are frustrating to us as analytical thinkers, because organic processes have always that mixture of patterns of development which are predictable. I mean, this is what I'm saying now as a principle of science, right? You have the frustrating process of, you've got predictability, certain patterns or laws of nature, but then you have all of this deviation, right? And to know which is the law and which is the deviation is not always so obvious. So she's always writing in a way that if you understand what she's saying, she's kind of forgiving you for kind of like, you're still getting it. You haven't gotten there, it's okay. You're in the process of becoming. She'll say this a lot. So I think you've got the idea. So for Edith, every human soul has a gestalt. And this gestalt is the way to think about it, is like what your soul should be. Like there's a goal or an ideal. And the gestalt should be thought of as, again, both a goal, something that you're aiming to become, but also a drive, something that's pushing you from the back, right? So there's some natural process that wants you to be a certain way, but it's also a goal for you. So this is a lot. And each of the things, these goals and these drives, or this urge, she uses the language of urge, right, can be sort of developed on their own. And that would take us too far off. So I want to just get this kind of gestalt thing going. All right, so where are we now? All right, we're back to this. We're back to the teaser. I promise we would get to what that is. There's one more tiny detour we have to take before we can get to what that is. And that is the following. So Edith, again, when I said that when she's getting practical, she's still very theoretical. So in these essay, Fundamental Principles of Women's Education, she has, you know, in all of these ones, she has this refined taxonomy, the way she thinks about what people are. And it emerges in me, if you were to sit down in one sitting and read every single essay, it kind of comes up to, like, and I tried to summarize it for you here, but she doesn't ever totally lay it out in one paragraph. It's kind of all there. And what is this? She works with a kind of a threefold schema. So basically she thinks, look, everybody's a person. Everyone's a human being. And if you're a human being, you have a common end as a human being. And your common end is God. Right? you're called to sanctification. You're called to be united with God. And so male or female, we all share this. This is our common humanity. It's the universal nature. The second thing for her, and she would actually use this language of dual species. So our species is Homo sapiens, but then she would say, like, there's another species, there's like a subspecies. Now this becomes philosophically very confused for people who are classical philosophers, but she wasn't really a classical philosopher, so it's all right. So she would say, all right, well, we're species, we're humans, we're the human species, and we have this common nature, but then we're male and female, and that's another species. So in the category of people who are like strong feminist thinkers, Edith Stein should be included in that category, although the feminists don't like her. But if you were going to go ahead and throw her into a list of feminist thinkers, you know that feminist thinkers can get divided up as gender essentialists or as gender non-essentialists. She's an extreme gender essentialist who thinks that male and female are so different, we're almost like different species, right? Now, like from a biological perspective, that makes no sense at all, but that's not what she means. She means we're just really different. So maleness and femaleness are totally different things, and we share, we're part of the same human nature, but once we start talking about maleness and femaleness, now we're talking about very different things. So she's a gender essentialist. Now, why don't the feminist thinkers like her? Because they can't do anything with the religious part of her thought. So for instance, she's a gender essentialist who thinks a woman cannot fulfill herself except through prayer. Well, this doesn't work for most of the feminists. She's just a mess for the feminists. She's very tough on women, actually. She's in a good way, but she's, anyway. So basically, these are the two subspecies. There's a species and then there's the subspecies. So I said this was a threefold thing. So you're a human being, you're a man or a woman, and then the third thing is what she would call your type or your individuality, which is like you're you and you're not me. And within the types, she's kind of like, there's all kind of people, right? And she has a very explicit, she writes it very explicitly, and I actually didn't bring this part for you because I've got too much other stuff. Very explicit, she says, look, a lot of particular types of women and particular types of men may have traits which are similar to the opposite gender. So there could be like male type of women who are women and they're completely, essentially, totally women, but they have some traits which are kind of like male traits. Now, I think this is true, and she thought it was true, but one of the reasons that, if you read through all of her life work and everything else, one of the reasons I think it was so clear to her, not just teaching girls, she felt like she had a lot of masculine traits. Now, I don't mean that if you saw her walking down the street, you'd be like, there was a man. I don't mean that. But she felt that in terms of personality type, she shared a lot of masculine traits. Most of her friends in the university were men. And I think that that was something that she liked. I mean, she liked that aspect of herself. She liked the kind of thinker that she was. So it was normal for her to have spent a lot of time writing about that. And she thought that was really important to have this third piece. Like, you couldn't stop at male and female. Why do you need a third piece? Because otherwise, you were going to ruin people by saying, well, there's one type of woman, and there's one type of man. Because then, why does she think you're going to ruin people? Because you're educating people. Because she's writing to educators, and she's writing for herself. So you ruin people if you don't take individuality seriously. You'd be like, well, everybody has to look this way. Everybody has to do this. Everybody has to have this kind of education. She's like, no way. You can't generalize about individuality. There's just no generalizing. So this is very interesting. So I have some quotes for you here. Okay, so just this quote right here. It is not possible to generalize about individuality as one might generalize about perfected humanity or perfected womanhood. In other words, if you can't generalize, there isn't such a thing as sort of a perfection of your individuality. There is a perfection of your womanhood, and there is a perfection of your humanity. What's the perfection of humanity? Holiness. It's the same for both men and for women. But then there's this perfected maleness, perfected femaleness. But once you get to individuality, she says there's no perfection. It's just you have this calling in you to be the kind of person that you are. Now, obviously, if you took the individuality thing on its own, right, you took it out from the subspecies and the species, you could just be all over the map. You could have like a completely untethered idea of what people are. But for her, it wasn't like running away like the cart without the horse, because it's always attached. It's like, well, your individuality could be all kinds of things, right? All kinds of things that don't fit normal stereotypes or everything. But you're still called to holiness, which means your individuality can't be like, my big thing is I'm called to be a sinful person, right? That doesn't work, right? So it's all the things underneath humanity and maleness and femaleness that are kind of like legitimate human goals to have and ways of being that are not, you know, otherwise forbidden or sinful. So that's very lovely. I think it's a lovely way to think about things. What else do I have for you? Okay. So she says, so here's a couple things. You can already tell, like this, I have to kind of bend over backwards to find the way of bringing this together, but I'm quoting from all different essays all over the place. I'm trying to put some order on a lot of stuff that's all over the place. So I want to point out that she believes that gender identity, if you will, is really complex. Like, people are complex to begin with, and then this gender stuff is complex, and then the fact that you could be sort of like a female-ish male or male-ish female, like, she thinks that's all fairly complex. But she says many times, although this is complex, it's not obscured from discovery. Like, we can know things about perfected womanhood and perfected manhood. So she finds it important to say that, because she's writing at a time when not everybody is a gender essentialist, and people are already starting to say maybe there is no difference, and maybe we don't really know. So she knows it. She knows that that's out there in the water. And it's out there in the water in, like, 1920, okay? So, like, we're not exactly charting new waters. We just aren't. I have some other ones for you. One of the next slides, she sort of is like, anybody that denies this is just blinded to reality. I mean, she knows she's sort of like taking a rhetorical position. But she basically says, look, we're not, although it's difficult to figure these things out, we have like a number of ways. She says, how do we know this call here is like maleness and femaleness? And she says, well, God himself declares it in the scripture. It's inscribed in the nature of man and woman, like what you can observe from biological cues, the way our bodies are made. And then she says also history elucidates the matter for us. And finally, the needs of our time sort of declare this. And so she basically says, look, it's a diversely fibered texture. It's complicated, but it's not so complicated that we can't see some stuff. And that's sort of the beginning of this essay on the separate vocations of men and women. And why is she saying it's not so complicated? Again, because there are people standing around in 1920 that are saying, maybe it is too complicated, we can't figure it out. So just for fun, I brought for you one of my favorite lines from John Stuart Mill. John Stuart Mill is a philosopher and also sort of an economist. But this is his classic kind of gender skepticism. This is John Stuart Mill from a wonderful and completely interesting and infuriating essay called The Subjection of Women, in which John Stuart Mill says at some point, standing on the ground of common sense and the constitution of the human mind, and he's like a rhetorical genius, I deny that anyone can know the nature of the two sexes. So I'm kind of pointing out that when Edith Stein says in 1920, a little bit after John Stuart Mill was writing, well, you know, a couple of decades after that, when she says it's complicated, but we can know this, she's not anticipating us today being like, whoa, we don't know. She's also responding to people in her present time who are saying, well, we could never know. And why did John Stuart Mill think that? That's another lecture. It's really interesting, but he kind of... So she knows she's saying stuff that runs up against a lot of the leading thinkers of her time, just like people would be today.
So here's another one, which is just lovely. So she, again, knowing this,
knowing that she's writing against a lot of other people, she says, only the person blinded by the passion of controversy, you know, or kind of like the cultural waters, could deny that woman in soul and body is formed for a particular purpose. So she thinks it's like, you know, you have to basically put the blinders on and be a, you know, sort of a know-nothing. It's, you know, clear from scripture, and then she wants to appeal to the essentially the physical and the spiritual attributes, and then finally from this Thomistic principle, which I'm going to spend a little more time on in a minute, the principle anima forma corporis, which is that the soul forms the matter, that such a spiritual characteristic, which is the nature of woman, that it does exist. So there's a couple of notes of her thought here in this passage. The first is just her strength of mind, right? She's very comfortable arguing against people like John Stuart Mill and lots of his followers, which are her contemporaries. The second here is her very strong sense of the order of reality, which is sort of matter is dead on its own. Matter doesn't give rise to anything. Your body doesn't tell your soul what kind of soul to be. Your soul tells your body what kind of body to be. So this is a very difficult thing for most of us to figure out, but it's a Thomistic principle. It's an Aristotelian principle. And it goes all the way back. So spirit, or the anima, is what gives the form or the gestalt to the matter, right? Here's another example of that kind of real attachment to the order of things. I don't know, this isn't working. It's in the clicker. There's the clicker. This is from a separate work altogether. If humans rank above the lower creatures because as spirit they imitate God, their generative power too must be rooted in the spirit. Now that's when she says the generative power, she means their maleness and femaleness must also be rooted in the spirit. So she really thinks, in some sense, contra the Thomists, that there's something we could call a male soul and a female soul. And this is where she runs up against the Thomists. And she was convinced it wasn't really a big problem. Their current Thomists think it is a really big problem. I'm fairly persuaded that there's a way to reconcile it. But, you know, for today, the goal is just to see what is it that she thinks and then see what you think.
Okay. So now we'll finally get back to that.
So here's the that, which is the ideal gestalt of the feminine soul.
So I'm not going to completely unpack this, but I kind of want to give it to you just as a sense,
just give you a sense of like the depth of her thought. And then what I'm going to do after that is give you about 5 or 6 specific points about what she thinks is going on with femaleness. And at the end, if I have any time, I'll give you a clue as to what she thinks is happening with maleness. So basically, this is maybe one of the most well-beloved passages in all of her work. She says that the soul of a woman must be expansive. So if you're wondering all along, well, what's perfected womanhood? If I'm checking into myself today, and whether I'm a good woman, according to each sign, I would have to be like this. This is what I would have to be like. And my soul would have to be like this. You know, you can see right away, like, it'd not be totally easy to figure this out. But it would definitely give you a lot to pray about, right? And you could sort of think about this. You could just do a whole retreat for yourself just with this one, right? So what are you supposed to be? You're supposed to be expansive and open to all human beings. You're supposed to be quiet. What does it even mean to have a quiet soul? It's really interesting in and of itself, isn't it? And why quiet? So that small, weak flames would not be extinguished by stormy winds, like in your soul. Okay, what does that even mean? That's a lot. Like, it's really interesting. The soul of a woman should be warm so that it doesn't kind of basically cause frost to small buds, like it's like frozen, right? Like, you shouldn't be like Elsa and cause it to freeze. I mean, it's a lovely, actually, it's just, I think it's very intuitive. Like, a bad woman is a cold woman, right? That's a bad woman. But, so yeah, woman, the soul of woman's soul should be very warm. And also, it should be clear. The soul should be clear. I gotta tell you, she's getting clear. Some of this is actually very closely coming out of St. Teresa of Avila's discussion of what the soul is like, which is really interesting. But what is even a clear soul? Do you know if your soul is clear? So why should it be clear? So that no vermin will settle in dark corners, like there's no spiders in your soul in the corner, or crickets, or whatever else you don't like. Because that could happen. I mean, that could happen to your soul. Your soul should also be self-contained, so that no invasions from without could peril your inner, your inner life. The soul should also be empty of itself. I don't even understand that, right? How is the soul empty of itself? But it should essentially not be self-centered, right? Why? So that other life would have room in it. I mean, this is really like a womb image, right? So like if you are full of yourself, you don't have room for other people. And we all kind of intuit these things, but this is really just lovely. And then finally, this this ideal woman, this gestalt, this female soul, the woman should be mistress of itself. The soul should be in charge of itself. It should be self-disciplined, and also of the body. But you see how the body gets short-tripped. The body's at the end. It's like, well, the soul should be mistress of itself, and then of course the soul should be mistress of the body, but like that goes without saying. So like, if it's mistress of its soul, it will be mistress of the body. And why? Why? Like, this is great. Not because it's great to be self-disciplined, but because it's great to be able to then put your whole person at the disposal of anyone that needs you. So if at 2 a.m. someone needs you, you can be there, right? So you're not like, oh, I'd rather be in bed, right? Now, I mean, if you weren't already there, you know, you have an infant and then you start to get there, right? There's all kinds of things that help you along this path, right? But it should be sort of the case that like over time, I mean, in Edith's mind, and what she's thinking, it should be the case that over time as you're a being in becoming, like you practice being available to people who need you, and that as you kind of keep going in life, you don't like flatten out, you don't like hit a stride when you're 18 and that's kind of as good as you're going to get. It should be that when you make progress, you become more mistress of yourself and more available and more clear and more open and more expansive and all those things, right? So none of this is supposed to be static. It's supposed to be being and becoming. And so that's pretty great stuff, right? Okay, so what else can we say about the feminine? And I have, and this is lovely, just to sort of tie this together, again, what feminists hate this stuff. So she says again, she says, now that is an ideal image of the gestalt of the soul. The soul of the first woman, Eve, was formed for this purpose, and so too is the soul of the mother of God. In all other women since the fall, there is an embryo of such development. Like, it's an embryo in all of you. It's there, just like Eve and in Mother Mary. But it needs cultivation. Cultivation, that language of the plants again. Right? So, like, it's in there. You have it. Don't worry. You have it. But you have to water it. You have to give it good soil. You have to cultivate it so that the seed of your development wouldn't be suffocated by the weeds. Again, all that organic language. Very, very, it's like her, it's what she says all the time. It's how she thinks about it. Okay, so now I'm going to get specific. So what does she really think? I mean, that's a very lovely like description of, you know, a certain kind of ideal, right? But let's be specific. So these are kind of 6 points I want to bring to your attention. And by the time we get to the sixth, like, I'll do it very quickly. You'll have a pretty good sense of what she thinks about men and women.
So the first point is that she, like John Paul II, will insist that the original vocation of woman is spouse and mother. Now, she means that spiritually and physically, right? So she was called to the convent, so she didn't think everybody had to actually get married. But she thought, you could intuit it in that earlier paragraph, she thought essentially that the fundamental drive in the female soul, like this gestalt, this ideal soul, and I think I have it here for you, the deepest feminine yearning is to achieve a loving union, which in its development validates its maturation and stimulates and furthers desire for perfection in others. So it's the yearning to a union, so that's the spousal vocation for her, which leads to a kind of fruitfulness, which is like motherhood, leads to fruitfulness, which is what? The desire for perfection in others. So for her, the way you think about motherhood is actually helping others to reach their perfection. So of course, conceiving and bearing children is part of that, right? But for people like herself, who are called to spiritual motherhood, what would that mean? What would it mean taking such a personal interest in the good of another person? That you're always willing to help and to see. And of course she, like, so you realize John Paul II was very influenced by her thought, spent a lot of time reading her. So when John Paul II writes in Moliere, Signitatem, that one of the special gifts of women is to see, like, the person, and to sort of be like, oh, I know what you need. Or let me encourage you in this. Like, she thinks that's very feminine. And she thinks, of course, that women called to spiritual motherhood are supposed to do this, but she also just thinks this is what women do. Like, it's what they're naturally trying to do from the day they're born. You know, and, you know, again, like,
because of the types of individuality that we talked about, some women reveal this in their personality more obviously than others. So I have two daughters, and when they were little, one of them was much more drawn to playing with dolls than the other one, but they're both nurturing people. They just have very different ways of showing it and different ways of being nurturing, right? My husband is nurturing in his own way. It's not like a normal, you know. The point is, you know, if you just met him briefly, you'd be like, yeah, that's not nurturing at all. So she thinks like this is what women do. They naturally see the person and they want in general, they take a deep interest in people. Now, I said earlier, she's kind of tough on women. She also thinks that's the origin of women's like a defect that women have, which is to be like too interested in gossip and people's lives. Like, where does that come from? She says, well, it comes from this natural calling to be interested in people. But if it gets distorted in the wrong direction, it turns into being like really interested in gossip or reading People magazine and whatever. I don't even want you to have said about social media. Like, that is all women.
That's what she would have said. But so she was very tough on women, really. She thought, that's what she thought women at a certain age, we got practical for 5 seconds, should have a lot of math education. She thought math education at a certain age was really helpful for kind of balancing out a tendency to just want to go to the next person. So she thought they have to have a little bit of math to become more balanced. Okay, so spouse and mother. So this is really interesting, and you're going to ask me, like, well, what about men? And I'm going to get there. What else? Here's another example. So I'm just kind of bringing you parts of her text. The deepest longing of a woman's heart is to give herself lovingly. I mean, you think of feminists like this? I mean, no, not at all. To belong to another and to possess this other being completely. You know, nobody would accuse Edith Stein of being a romantic. Have you ever seen a picture of her? She's a very serious looking person. But when you read her text carefully, you're kind of like, there's a lot of passion there. She was like clearly a very, very passionate person. This longing is revealed in her outlook, her personal and all-embracing kind of attitude, which appears to us as specifically feminine. Right? So this is a lovely passage. Let me see if I have another one. Here's another one, and I've just kind of underlined the particular point that we're on, which is that the woman's nature is determined by her original vocation of spouse and mother. One depends upon the other, so for her, it was always spouse and mother. Like, it's like one word. And in German, you can do that. You can make words like out of 10 words, and that's just all one word. So for her, it was always spouse and mother. So the body of woman, she's pointing out, is fashioned to be one flesh with another and to nurse new human life. A well-disciplined body is an accommodating instrument for the mind, which animates it. Now, this isn't about a woman. This is just a principle. A well-disciplined body is an instrument for the mind. This is very interesting. And she says, at the same time, this well-disciplined body is a source of power and a habitat for the mind. Well, just so, a woman's soul is designed to be subordinate to a man in obedience and support, but also fashioned to be a shelter in which other souls may unfold. These are really kind of key principles for her, which she develops at length. You know, I'm kind of just giving you the teaser. But I think after tonight, if you were to open up the essay, you would find it easier to read. Both spiritual companionship, which is another word for spousal vocation, and spiritual motherliness are not limited to the physical spouse and mother, but they extend to all people with whom woman comes into contact. So, like, in other words, she's always trying to be completely united with you, and she's always trying to nurture you. Like, if you meet a really good woman, she's doing all that, all the time. And again, you can see how, like, that natural, you know, that natural tendency to want to be united with you, like, if she's your good friend. I mean, that could have, like, it could have some dangers. There could be some dangers there. But, you know, mostly she's talking about this as a strength.
It's a strength of spirit.
Okay, so here's another feature. She thinks that women in particular are called to, so remember, this ideal gestalt is about not just a description of who you are, like the seeds are in you, but also what you're called to become. You're called to a special unity or integration. So I'm going to go back to that for a second. So a special unity or integration of the spirit and the body, right? So we have this principle that we're a body and a soul united, and she thinks women are both are and also are drawn to really being specially integrated in that way. So she says, now this is really interesting, she says this is purely speculative. She's not here to say this is, you know, handed down from St. Thomas. This is very speculative. She says, I would like to believe, which is for her, like, it's at the end of an arm. It's not like, here's a doctrine, but it's like, I would kind of like to believe, and I'd like to make this more solid if I can get there. She doesn't really get there, but it's about what she says about it. I would like to believe that the relationship between the soul and the body is not the same in men and women. With women, she thinks, the soul's union with the body is more naturally, intimately emphasized. Women's soul is present and lives more intense. This is like the Aristotelians jump out the window. At this point, they're ready to just like burn the book. Handle this. Right? Because like, if you take hylomorphism seriously for the Aristotelians and Thomas, this doesn't make any sense at all. Like, right? Again, I think it gives us a lot and it's worth taking seriously. Woman's soul is present and lives more intense in all parts of the body and is inwardly affected by that which happens to the body. Whereas with men, she says, the body has pronouncedly the character of an instrument which serves them in their work and which is accompanied by a certain detachment. Okay, now if you've ever met like a 12-year-old boy, you know that this is sort of true. Like, 12-year-old boys just throw their bodies at stuff, like all the time. And then the women are like, oh, it's very different. It's a love, again, it's a really kind of, she's feeling around something. Now she says, why does she think this? She says, well, I think this is closely related to the vocation of motherhood. So for her, like, women are sort of interior. Like, everything's kind of focused on the interior. Why? Well, because if, like, a whole human person might be living inside you, well, it'd be really good if you were, like, really present. You weren't like, I'm just gone someplace else. Or if you just thought you could take total risks with your body, even though there's a being depending upon you. So, you know, many women do have that experience, like I love to ride roller coasters before I had children and then after I had children, I was like, no way, which is silly, they're not really risky, but it's just this thing happens to you, and you're like, well, I can't be hurtling through the air at 90 miles an hour, I have a baby down there. There's this thing that happens, which is you feel like you can't take risks with your body anymore. Then it's a different approach. So this is an interesting thought, it's speculative for her, it's not something that's like a doctrine, but it's something that she thought was true. Here's another example of it. She says, the task of assimilating in oneself a living being which is evolving and growing, of containing it, nourishing it, right, that this, she sort of has, one is well able to understand that this kind of unity imposes itself in the entire nature of woman. If you want to extend this a little bit and think about where would you sort of see this thing, well, she thinks this is why women have such a hard time, like, do men complain a lot about the difficulties of balancing work and family? No, they don't. Women do, because they feel divided. They don't like division. So she thinks, like, that women have a distaste for division. They also have a, they're drawn to integrity. So women are going to be the whistleblowers. Like, they don't want to bifurcate parts of their lives. Sometimes people use this language that the men can compartmentalize. You're like, you know that whole thing? She's kind of on to that. That's kind of what she's getting at. She's like, the guys are like, well, we can be one thing over there and be one thing over here. Well, I can live with that for a while. She doesn't think women have a very easy time living with a divided life. And she thinks that's because ultimately they have this fundamental urge and calling to both union and to motherhood. So that, in fact, imposes itself in their whole being. They just don't like this unity. They don't like any of that. What else did she say? Here's one last point on this one. She says, a quality unique to woman is her singular sensitivity to moral values, an abhorrence for all which is low and mean. Allied closely to this sensitivity for moral values is her yearning for the divine and her own personal union with the Lord. So she basically thinks it's like not an option for women to sort of ignore the fact that they're called to be in union with God. It's kind of like if they want to ignore that, they're just going to cease to be good women. So she's sort of pretty tough on women in this sense. She thinks that's basically what's always going on. Okay, the third point were these sorts of characteristics of the feminine. She spends a lot of time talking about women's spiritual powers. This is kind of
a kind of language that for those of us today, like in English, on our ears, it sounds a little bit New Agey, maybe, but it didn't sound that way to her. While I just mentioned that she's kind of tough on the women, she thinks basically like if you're not pursuing union with God all the time, if you're not taking your spiritual life really seriously, you're going to cease to be a good woman. By the same token, she thinks, well, the reason for that is because women have very special spiritual powers. So why wouldn't you want to activate those? So that language of activation of powers, again, like it's either New Age or it's like Marvel. But these are both languages that she used all the time. So I have some nice examples for you again. So here's what I have. So a woman can achieve perfect development of her personality only by activating her spiritual powers, right? So kind of like, wow, she's flying around or whatever she's doing, floating, with anyone floating at mass, you know? But, you know, she really thinks that that's a strength, that this is somehow, if we take it seriously, that it should not be that hard for us. Whereas for men, she thinks not that it's hard. She thinks men have to like wrestle with themselves to do this. That what the first thing a man has to do when he wakes up in life, which could be like at the age of 35, but maybe hopefully it's earlier. The first thing a guy has to do is like St. John of the Cross, go out to the desert and like wrestle himself. So she's obviously highly influenced by St. John of the Cross, and she's a rebel in this sense. But she thinks basically if a woman is living a life of grace, and was well educated, it should be almost a perfect, seamless, natural process by which she starts to become acquainted with the life of prayer, because it's like what we were supposed to just be doing. Like this should be feel completely normal to us. That's what she thinks. So the strength of woman lies in her emotional life, which is translated here emotional, but this is would have been more sort of spiritual, emotional. Here's another example. Let's see. Woman naturally seeks to embrace that which is living, personal, and whole, to cherish, guard, protect, nourish. These are all sort of characteristics related to that first paragraph, which I showed you. And always this kind of advancing growth is her natural maternal yearning. She likes to, like, mother things. You know, there's this thing where, like, women in the workplace are mothering everything, right? And this is one of the things people complain about. You can open the New York Times right now and read dozens and dozens of newspaper stories, very fresh and recent, about how women do more housekeeping at the office. There's a constant complaint, like, because the guys don't clean up after themselves, and actually the guys don't care, but the women there care. They don't want to see a mess, so they're sort of, so they do more housekeeping at home, and they do more housekeeping at work because they care. The guys don't care. So, you know, she sort of thinks that's what they do all the time. They just go around and, like, do maternal stuff. You know, so you, I mean, it's sort of funny, right, but she has the faculty to interest herself empathetically in areas of knowledge far from her own concerns and to which she would not pay heed if it were not that a personal interest drew her into contact with them. I mean, obviously, right, this has a strength and it has a weakness, right? This kind of like almost obsessive ability to get into somebody else's life really fast and to want to know all the details. True feminine qualities are required forever. Well, these are these features for true feeling, intuition, empathy, adaptability come into play. All this, and you know, I kind of want to point out, you know, you can read this yourself. I kind of want to point out that again, for her, something like true feeling, empathy, adaptability, they don't always have to look the same. They don't always have to look like feminine in some kind of stereotypical way. But she always thinks that this is what's going on. Woman is mainly concerned with serving people and making provisions for them. Of course, she did spend some time thinking about what kinds of professions. Why? Actually, she's interesting. She said she would get called to talk about women's professions a lot, and she would write a bunch of stuff about it, and she would speak about it, and then she would almost scold her audience at the end and say, "You know, why are you so obsessed with this? Why is it such an interesting question? What professions women should be in?" She's like, "They can do anything they want." She would say that. She'd be like, "They're just going to do it in their way. They're going to do it the way women do things." So she said, well, okay, they can do everything. You know, education, medicine, social work, human sciences, the arts, the business world, public and parochial. I mean, she basically, in a couple of other passages, she basically says, there's really nothing a woman can't do in her way. She's just going to do it in her way. So she also didn't think there should be any legal barriers to women doing anything.
in particular. But I will qualify that in a moment as I start to wrap up here. So another example of, as I pointed out, this kind of intense prescription she placed on the importance of religious formation. So I just want to highlight this last, it doesn't match what I'm looking at. This last sentence. So women can become what she should become only in conformity with her primary vocation, only when formation through grace accompanies the natural inner formation. Because of this, religious education must be the core of all women's. I mean, she wouldn't even understand the situation in which all education is public education. The Pope at the same time in Rome, around 1930, was sort of denouncing public education. I mean, this comes up against all kinds of things that you might want to talk about. But just for the moment, I just wanted to highlight how much she thinks religious education is sort of the core. She thinks religious education should be the core of men's education too. She just wasn't writing about men in this essay. So let's see, couple of tiny points, and I have about 5 more minutes and I'll wrap up. A couple of short points about women and motherhood, work, and vocation. I think I want to move to this one. So she said, we should accept as normal that the marriage, so although she thought every profession should be open to women, for sure, she's probably rather ahead of her time in that respect, she also said we should accept as normal that the married woman is restricted, and she doesn't mean like legally restricted, she just means kind of like culturally restricted, to domestic life at a time when her household duties extract her total energies, and she means basically children. She said any social condition is an unhealthy one which compels married women, meaning like by force of need, to seek employment and makes it impossible for them to manage their home like while trying to work. So she means sort of like if the economy is such that it's like impossible for people to make it on one income and people have to go to work when they really want to be at home with their babies, like, well, we should pronounce that as sort of an unjust situation. She doesn't say what we ought to do about it. She just sort of says like, that's not right, right? It should be that people could be home managing their homes and their children when they have small children. This is an interesting comment she makes about women who have to work, who are either forced into the workplace or otherwise. Many of the best women are almost overwhelmed by the double burden, and this is I'm inserting this. Those of you who are students of sociology will know this language of the second shift. Current sociologists observe that women who are working come home and then have to do a whole second work shift at home, usually, because they're either better at doing those things at home or that's how the family works out better. So she's writing about a double burden, which sounds a lot like a second shift. You know, 75 years before the language of second shift appears in the cultural lexicon. A double burden of family duties and professional life are often simply of just employment. And such women are always on the go, they're harassed, they're nervous, and they're irritable. So she's already observing that in cases where people are like forced to go make a living when, you know, their time is split, this could not work out well. So, you know, put them together. She thinks there are lots of reasons why women may be pursuing professional life, but let's be honest, like if you have 2 full-time jobs, it's going to be hard, because that's really what it's like, right? To take care of your home and your children full-time and to work full-time. It's like 2 full-time jobs. And if you're not careful, it could... Now, what does she say, actually, to the women in this audience when she's writing this essay? She's kind of like, well, we may not be able to change the situation, but you have to pray more, because then you won't be so stressed out. So this is like one answer. Let me see. And I think I mentioned this to you before. She says, every profession in which woman's soul comes into its own and which can be formed by woman's soul is a woman's profession. In other words, like nothing off the table. You could be a construction worker. I don't know what else. You could be anything. Maybe not an ice trucker. She just had no problem. But then it's always balanced out with this woman's soul wins this formative principle through the most intimate union with the divine. Other type of divine heart in a Eucharistic and liturgical life. And let's see, I already told you about that, and then women in the church. So she has a really wonderful ecclesiology of the church. So she thinks a lot about how woman, like all of that stuff, we just wrote the ideal of the salt of the feminine soul, all of that stuff tells us what the church is supposed to be like. And if the church isn't like that, the church isn't living up to her ideal calling. And so she sort of has some words about that in other places. But she says, woman, for instance, is called to embody in her highest and purest development the essence of the church, to be its symbol. So actually go back to that language of Platonic form, just as the circle is to things which are spherical, the ideal soul of the woman is actually the form of the church. Like, that's pretty cool, right? So she has this whole ecclesiology of Mary, ecclesiology of the church, this lovely essay on the church and woman. Lots and lots of examples of this. This is a nice one. Every soul purified through baptism and raised to the state of grace is thereby conceived through Christ and is born for his sake, yet the soul is conceived in and born through the church. So she starts to like draw out this analogy of like how souls are conceived in the church and then they're born from the church, which is, you know, it's always been there, but it's this kind of very physical assimilation of what it looks like to be a woman who conceives and bears children, and what the church is sort of doing, what the business of the church is. It's very visceral. So she says, well, okay, that the church is thus the mother of all the redeemed. Here's another example. We may consider the church as a supernatural mother of whom woman is an essential organ. And then I'm going to just leave you off at the very end here. Or I can just leave this for questions and answers. We're like, what are men then? Every time I give this, everybody wants to know, what does she think about men? And the bottom line is she didn't talk as much about men as she talked about women. So we don't know a ton about it, but there's a lot of little sections. So I don't know if I brought any actual quotes here. So this is probably one of the best ones. There's longer sections. So she thinks the original calling of man is not to be spouse of women. Woman is spouse and mother for men. And in this way, she starts to, again, she irritates some of the 20th century phenomenologists this way. Man was called by his original vocation to be master of the created world. So hence his body and soul are equipped to fight and to conquer the world, the created world, to understand it, to buy knowledge, to make it his own, to possess it and enjoy it, and finally to make it, in a sense, his own creation through purposeful activity. So those are all things she thinks are essentially sort of male, principal male vocation. So you might say, well, aren't men called to be like husbands and fathers? And she says, absolutely yes, of course they are. But for her, that is, it's something that comes through this. So actually, men become husbands and fathers, so they achieve union and fatherhood through their mastery of the world. So they master the things which are theirs. They take possession of them, they cultivate them, they make them their own, and they make them fruitful. I know. But you're supposed to think of the good king, right? Or the good farmer who takes possession of his land and cares for it, like, right, in a nurturing way, makes it his own. So she basically says, it's just kind of funny, whereas she sort of says this, and I don't think I brought this because it's too many different paragraphs that I have to summarize. It's like it would be too many slides. But she basically says, here's the asymmetry. Women are called to be queens, just like men are called to be kings. Mastery is this thing, right? Mastery is kingship. So women are called to be queens, as men are called to be kings, but it's the opposite. So women become queens through that spouse and mother thing. So how? They become queens by marrying the king. But all the guys are called to be king principally, like, because king is master. So they're called to be king, and because of being king, they take care of the land, they take care of the families. And so through their kingly vocation, they become husbands and fathers. So that's what the king does. The king takes his bride, and he makes her the queen. And of course, the good king elevates his queen, right? And nobody messes with his queen. So you're supposed to think about this in the best way, right? But the minute it comes out of your mouth, you go, oh, no, somebody's not going to like this at all. But it's very, very interesting. It's very, very interesting, isn't it? And it certainly
conforms to a lot of the fairy tales and a lot of the things we think about in that kind of, I would almost just say it's a very literary way of thinking about this sort of the complementarity of these two different vocations. I think it's one of the most interesting parts of her thought about maleness and femaleness. And I wish that she had talked more about the male vocation as much as she talked about, but she didn't. So I'm going to leave you right there. That is it. I talked fast enough. It's all done.